dear listeners, my name is Olga Lukina. I'm a board-certified behavior analyst-certified occupational therapist. The main goal of this podcast is to inform families who raise children with autism, as well as specialist teachers and other interested listeners, about the difficulties and scientifically approved therapies to improve the quality of life of people with autism. So today we will have a great conversation on the topic self-care skills in people with autism with occupational therapist Dr. Aditi Mihra. Hello, Dr. Aditi. Thank you for attending my podcast, and I look forward to discussing today's topic, that is self-care skills in people with autism, and we will make it practical and discuss different cases from my practice. So far, I know that you are an occupational therapist, a university professor, and also a podcaster, and you also are interested in developing a data collection system for occupational therapists in everyday practice. So can you introduce yourself to our listeners and also say a little bit more about your success in a data collection system?
Well, thank you so much for having me on. Yes, I to all of the above, except I'm no longer a podcaster. I'm actually a YouTuber.
Okay.
I just switched because I realized that I wasn't enjoying the podcasting medium as much. I like the visual aspect of YouTube. So just to correct you there. And my journey, so I've been an OT for, 25 years now. And I've worked in so many settings, NICU, school, outpatient, inpatient, anything and everything, I've sort of done it. And one of the things that bothered me in the last 5 years, I realized that people stopped believing certain interventions that we were doing, specifically sensory. And that's when I was like, it really bothered me because I was like, I know it, you know, certain things work, or maybe they don't work, but there was no way for me to show it. And that's how I was really started getting really interested in data. And at the same time, my son was struggling in school. I was doing my doctorate. I ran across the science of precision teaching in ABA. And I was like, oh my gosh, I need this for my son. And ended up getting certified and bringing it to Chicago, Illinois, which is where I live. So to answer your question, that's sort of how data collection came about. But my main goal for parents is always to make more progress and save time. And that's my tagline in my YouTube videos. Because as parents, we have such a short amount of time to make a difference. And as therapists, we have even shorter amounts of time, right? To make a difference. So it's really about making sure that we're using all our sciences, all the allied health fields together to say, this is what we need to do. And this is the fastest way to do it. And that's why I was so interested in other disciplines like ABA and speech and OT and how we can all collaborate.
Okay, thank you for introducing yourself. And let's start our discussion about self-care skills. So can you explain in general what are self-care skills?
Sure. Self-care is basically anything anyone needs to function on a daily basis. So meaningful activities that help you survive and engage in your environment, right? Eating, sleeping, bathing, dressing, all those are basic skills that every human being needs in order to function. That's what self-care is.
And what do you think, what factors can influence the participation in these activities within people with autism?
Well, there's several domains. When I put my OT lens on, the first thing I always look at is the sensory component. You know, what is impacting that child from a sensory perspective? What do I mean by that? Well, if a child does not tolerate the texture of a t-shirt, he's not going to want to get dressed. If the child doesn't like the smell of certain foods, he's not going to want to eat them. If a child does not like the feeling of water on his skin in a shower, he's not going to want to shower. So the sensory component is a huge component. And then what happens is I mean, that's a whole episode in itself, but basically children with autism often get stuck in the sensory world of what they like, and then they avoid things they don't like. So that's the first piece I always look at. And then I look at motor skills. What sort of motor skills do they have? Can they physiologically do an activity? Then I look at cognition, because if they don't know what eat means, it's going to be very difficult for you to teach that. If they don't know what a spoon is, it's going to be hard for you to teach them to use one. So you need to collaborate with a speech therapist to figure out the receptive language and expressive language. That's the cognitive component. Then there is the psychosocial, social emotional component. You know, the volition, do they want to eat? Because if they don't want to, then it's going to be very difficult for you to get it. So getting that buy-in from that child and doing it with them rather than to them. Okay. And then lastly, an aspect that I'm sure you're very familiar with is behavior. Every child, every adult, everybody has behavior.
Okay.
Right?
Can we mention also the environmental modifications?
Yes, absolutely. The environment is definitely key because, I mean, and that sort of plays into sensory too, you know, you want to adapt the environment, but also from a behavioral standpoint too.
Mm-hmm.
So yes, you're absolutely right.
Okay, great. So what kind of sensory issues do we need to take into consideration when planning the treatment process of self-care skills for people with
Well, autism? Self-care is kind of broad. You'd probably have to figure out, you know, because each sensory aspect will impact a self-care skill differently. So you'd have to figure out, you'd have to pick one and then parse it out and go, okay, so let's take an example of brushing teeth. The first thing you're going to look at from a sensory standpoint, does he or she tolerate the feeling of having their teeth brushed? And then if they don't, well, is it that they don't like how the toothpaste feels or the bristles of the toothbrush feel? Or is it the taste? Is it the smell? Or is it being in the bathroom where it's bright? Or, you know, or the temperature of the water? Like, so that's the first thing I go is I look at which aspect of sensory, because it's so broad, is an issue. Then you might go, well, okay, now I know he tolerates everything. So does he know how to hold the brush, the toothbrush? And then when with holding a toothbrush, there's so many elements. There's motor, but there's also the sensory aspect, right? Knowing how hard to hold it, how soft to hold it, how hard to push. So there's so many elements to that. Those are the two. And then, of course, if they can't hold a brush, then you're like, okay, is there an adaptation I need? Is there anything I can modify in the environment with the actual item? Then it's, does he know the steps? And starting where and what he knows. So if he knows how to pick it up, great. But he doesn't know the next steps. I would start there, pick up, and then put the, you know, you can do the toothpaste for him to provide more assistance and then slowly fade away that assistance. But I mean, there's so many ways to do it. I'm just giving you an example.
Yeah, great. Can you mention what kind of sensory systems we analyze?
Yes. So the biggest one with ASD that I've always used is the visual system, because generally speaking, and of course I can only be very general here, students with ASD really do well with visuals. So that's the first one. But from a sensory standpoint, you know, visual sensory aspects can also be very difficult for students. And I'll give you an example. I remember I had a student who every time I would see him, my session would vary. Sometimes it would be great, and other times it would be really bad. And he would squint and he would like, and I'm like, I don't understand. I'm the same person. We're in the same setting. And I found out that it was my shirt. I had the shirt that had lines. It was black and white lines. And every time I wore that shirt, he didn't like it. And he would squint and he would, and who would have thought, right? So really knowing what visually your child is attracted to and what visually your child does not like. And typically, if you have too much information, that's going to be too hard. That's why the, you know, the PEC system works so well, because it's very linear, concrete pictures. So that's visual. From olfactory is the next one, which is the sense of smell. You know, knowing that children can really like certain smells and look for them. Like, you know, I'm sure you've encountered this. I've had so many clients, mom will say, he just wants to smell me all the time. And I'm like, yeah, you know, I can see why that helps keep him alert and engaged. And then also they might say, well, you know, he can't stand the smell. Or sometimes this happened to me too. I was in a clinic setting, and you know how the rooms are kind of small. I don't know how they are there, but our rooms are very small, our treatment rooms. And the therapist was in there, and she has cologne on or a perfume or whatever. And I walk in the room and I can smell it, and it smells really good to me. But I know that child with sensory issues, that he doesn't tolerate smells as well. And so she says to me, you know, Johnny won't sit still for me. He's like whining, crying, not paying attention. I'm like, well, it may be because of the smell. So we have to be very careful and understand what we tolerate is not the same as what ASD children tolerate and enjoy. And then the other one is with foods. You know, my son had sensory issues, my middle one, and he could not stand it when I was cooking. Could not. I had to open all the windows and the doors, make sure all the smell was gone, and then he would come down to eat. So, you know, the sense of smell is very strong and can really elicit some major responses, especially because it's connected to the vagus nerve. Sorry, getting too technical, but yeah, it's connected to so many things. And then of course, proprioception. That is the information we get in our joints. So anything you do, like if you close your eyes right now, you could tell me where your body is in space. You could say, yes, I'm sitting like this. My legs are crossed. My feet are flat on the floor. It's because your joints are giving you information about your body and joints and muscles in space. It's telling you where they are. And that's proprioceptive input. And all of us need proprioceptive input to have a sense of awareness in our environment. So if you tell your child, go and get your cup. If they don't have good proprioceptive awareness, they're going to have a hard time trying to figure out where it is. First of all, how to pick it up and how to put it down, you know, and how to move their body to get it. When I used to work in early intervention, I had a little girl who the PT called me in because she was working on crawling, but this little girl would not crawl. And it turns out she has some major proprioceptive deficits. And if you think about a baby, they don't know they have legs unless they have good proprioceptive input, right? And so when finally we brought her legs into a visual field, then she's like, oh, I can move. And that's how I was able to work with the PT to do that. So proprioceptive input is very important. A lot of students with ASD will seek proprioceptive input. We see it in the head banging. We see it in the pinching. You know, they'll pinch themselves or other things. So that's a huge one. And then vestibular, which is your sense of movement and balance. A lot of children with ASD cannot tolerate vestibular in that. For example, I had a student who could not tolerate car rides. Now, with the vestibular system, your balance works with your visual vision. So for this student, what we did is we covered the window with black paper so she couldn't look out the window as she was riding the car. And that made a difference for her. You know, so really trying to figure out how does your child tolerate movement and, you know, how does it impact them? Most, again, I'm generalizing, a lot of children with ASD are often seeking movement, you know, and sometimes they are seeking that, you know, you might see them spinning or jumping, but you have to be careful because a lot of children, they seek that information, but then they can't always control it. Mm-hmm. So that's vestibular. And then there's also, so wait, did I do all the senses? Did I miss any yet?
I think we missed here.
Hearing and tactile, right? So hearing, now this is an interesting one. Everyone assumes that children with autism can be defensive of sounds, which is auditory defensiveness, right? I have not found the case always. And there are so many students who are actually seeking sounds. For example, I've had children who will constantly make noises with their mouth, constantly. Or I have had children, and I work in the school setting, and mom will say to me, I don't know why he can't sit still and do his homework. I have a really quiet environment. And I'm like, yeah, but he doesn't like a quiet environment, just because you and I assume he does. Or with sleep, you know how you assume that to sleep, children need lullabies and quiet. Not necessarily. There are children who will sleep better to the sound of a vacuum. Then my son, my sensory son, was exactly like that. I had to, when he was 9 months old, would not sleep. And I had to put my vacuum on, my Hoover. And I was like, I can't possibly have this on all day. So I actually bought a CD where it was a recording of the Hoover, and it just went over and in repeat. And it was funny, every time it would switch, you know, there'd be a gap, he would wake up a little bit. I'd be like, what? So anyway, my point is that auditory is a big component, and it's not always that auditory it's a defensive. It can be seeking, or it can be something to defensive with. And that impacts ADLs and self-care a lot, right? Because think about the toilet. If a child does not like the flushing of the toilet, that anticipation and anxiety really hurts and bothers them. And therefore they don't want to go to the toilet, right? So then we've got tactile, which is pretty self-explanatory. You know, there are certain things, even you and I, we have tactile issues. We don't like to touch certain things. I know I don't like to touch, you know, like sand is not my favorite. I can touch it, but it's not my favorite. So, and then there are people who really love and want to touch everything. And then you'll see those kids who need Play-Doh in order to pay attention. They might like the texture. And that impacts self-care too, because, you know, if you don't like certain foods, it's going to impact you. And clothing, it really impacts dressing, texture aversion. And then there's one more. It's actually the sense, it's an internal sense. It's called interoception. And that's basically how our body tells us, you know, if we're hungry, if we're thirsty. It's an internal system. So my son, my middle son, had failure to thrive. And I tried everything. It was 9 months of absolute. You know how it is when you have a child who has, it, you know, challenges. It turns your world upside down. And the thing with him that I noticed was he would drink like 3 ounces or 4 ounces of milk or formula, and he was full, happy as a clam, but full. And for an average baby, they should be drinking about 32 ounces, right, in a day. He was drinking 4 or 5 ounces, 8 ounces max. But nobody could find anything wrong with him. It's because his interoception system was telling him he was full, you know, and so that was impacting his ability to intake or eat. So interoception is one of those silent sensory systems that can really impact children with ASD too. I think that's all of them, right?
Yes, great. Thank you for great examples to understand how it works really in practice. And if we continue speaking about sensory issues, so what do you think? Do specialists and parents need to help a child to adapt to certain sensory stimuli, or it is more important to modify the environment so we can minimize the possibility of sensory overload? For example, I will give an example. If a child avoids wearing a top with a rough material, do we need to adapt him to this kind of materials, or we better change the top to some kind of soft materials he can tolerate?
Oh, that's such a good question, Olga, because, and I'll give you another example. And I'll answer yours, but I want to give you an example first. In our clinic, we had this mom. Every time she would bring her child in, she would say to me, he does not like normal room temperature. He needs it colder. So she would come in the clinic and she would change temperature in our clinic treatment room to 60 degrees Fahrenheit, which, what is that in Celsius? Centigrade or Celsius, I'm not sure, but it's cold. It's not your average, right? It's 10 degrees colder. And she insisted on doing this every time because she felt that, let's just call him Johnny. Johnny does not do well when it's warmer. And at first I was like, okay, I'm okay with it because I'm just getting to know him and I want him to be comfortable and I want to build a rapport and relationship. But then I finally had to tell mom, I'm like, this is not feasible. So to answer your question, I think modification has its place, but also in order for children to survive and learn to function in our world, they have to learn to adapt to our world, because you're doing them a disservice if you don't do both. And that's just my opinion. So take it for what you believe.
How we can find the balance between what we can adapt to or what we need to modify?
So, you know, that's where short-term and long-term goals come in, right? You know, like, and then of course it depends on the severity of the situation. So for example, if Johnny's not eating because food has to be at 10 degrees lower temperature than everybody else, you're going to have to do that for a while. Like that's a priority. But then, you know, I really believe in grading. So what I mean by that is, let's just say, and this happened, I had a client who would only eat food that was room temperature. Hot. It had to be like microwaved hot. And the problem is he was bringing food to school and we couldn't heat up the food. So he wouldn't eat. So mom said to me, how can we get him to eat? I said, okay, is he eating at home? Yes. Is he eating when he gets back from school? Yes. She goes, but he's hungry all day during school. I'm like, okay, so then this is what I would do. I would give him one food that you know he'll eat and we'll heat it up. And we'll tell him we'll do it for 1 or 2 months. But he has to eat one food, even if it's one bite, of something that's not hot. And that's how we graded the choices. So it's always, I want you to do what feels good to you and you can tolerate, but I want you to do a little bit more of what you can't, because in order to help you with life, you have to do that just a little bit. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't have to be a big, you know, it could just be one bite. But I just want you to do a little bit that's a little bit outside of your comfort zone. So, you know, isn't that what they say? Like, if you're not out of your comfort zone, you're not really learning. And that's what we have to apply in OT is, yes, we want to make them comfortable as possible in their sensory system so they can do self-care. But we want to also make sure that if they don't or they can't, or if once they can, that we are expecting them to do a little bit more outside of their comfort zone. So your example was, what was your question? The child who refuses to, What was it?
Yeah, it was an example that if a child can't tolerate rough materials, and what do we need to do to adapt or to modify the environment?
Sure. So that's a perfect example. So then I would say, okay, you know, you have five. And of course, I'm just giving you an example because mm-hmm. every child is different. So 90% of the time, 7 days a week, they wear soft material. That's what I would do for sure. But then, you know, if you're working with an OT, you would try some desensitizing techniques, maybe rubbing lotion, maybe, you know, brushing, those type of, and then say, you know, for 1 day a week or 1 hour or 10 minutes, depending on what they can tolerate, I want you to try to wear this shirt, which is not as soft, but it's not super hard. And I just want you to wear it and see. And, you know, what you can even do is just have them put their hand in the sleeve so they don't have to wear the whole thing. So it's grading. So the body mm-hmm. and the sensory system slowly gets used to that rougher material, because otherwise they're going to be dependent on soft material forever. And if you want them to be, that's fine then. You know, if you're okay with that goal, but that's what you would do.
Yeah, I just think that a parent or a specialist can face the problem behavior in these situations, because it can be a kind of ritualistic behavior too, if mm-hmm. we try to change to another material. So what can you advise in this situation if this is a behavior problem too?
So you're saying if you're introducing the rough material, for example, that the problems behaviors will start?
Yes. How can we know if this is like a sensory issue or more the kind of ritualistic behavior that he just doesn't want to take changes in this environment?
Yeah. that's very difficult. And obviously the first thing I would say is if you have access to a therapist, definitely, you know, get their advice, because again, this is very general advice. So in that situation, if you are encountering a lot of problem behavior with change, there are several things that I would try. The first thing I would try is I would just show them. So let's just say you have the one shirt that you want them to try. Let's just say you would put it in their environment every day. And you would just say, hey, I just need you to help me clean up, pick up this shirt and put it in the laundry basket, for example. So it's not the expectation is not to wear it. It's just a quick touch, put it in. You know, that would be one thing. The second would be a visual, you know, having them pick between two shirts so that it's a choice. It's always a choice. So, and how I would do that is say you have every day, so 7 days a week. So you have seven shirts you have to wear, right? And one card is the shirt that's the rough material, and you shuffle the cards like playing cards. All right, pick. And then he gets to pick. And then if he gets the soft shirt, great. If he doesn't, you can say, okay, well, now it's your choice. Do you want to wear it or not? If you do wear it, you can pair it with a reinforcing activity like iPad time or whatever. If you don't wear it, okay, that's fine. So my point is that you are giving as a choice rather than making them do it. And you're increasing the probability of them making that choice by having that shirt in the environment so that it doesn't feel like an anxiety situation. Oh, I'm used to touching the shirt. I put it on there all the time, you know, that sort of thing. And then peers and siblings. If you have peers and siblings, use them. You know, everybody's wearing the Spider-Man costume today for snack time. Do you want to try it? Yes, no, or maybe you just want to try with one sleeve, you know, that sort of thing. So again, it's a lot of grading, but pairing a lot of reinforcement with something that might be a little bit hard for them.
Thank you so much. Yes, I think the important point is also about the reinforcement. I think not a lot of occupational therapists know this term, reinforcement, and use it. I don't know how it's in America.
Oh, I think OTs are very aware of it here. I'm very proud of OTs in the US because we, you know, the one thing I've noticed is they really want to learn and collaborate with their with other therapists. And that's one of the things that motivated me is when my son was struggling with sensory issues, if I didn't have, or if I didn't understand behavior, it would be very hard for me to manage it. Because, you know, it's like me telling you, I want you to speak Chinese and you don't know how to speak Chinese, but I keep asking you to speak Chinese. You're not going to do it. But if I say, I want you to try to say this word in Chinese, and if you say it, I'm going to give you $10. You're going to do it, even if it's, you know, not brilliant. So that's an aspect of behavior is something that applies to anyone, whether you're a typical child or you have a child with ASD or Down syndrome or nothing, no diagnosis. We all have behavior. So I think every therapist needs to understand the basics of behavior. That's just my belief. And that's what I've always done.
Thank you. Yeah, this is a great answer. I also think about errorless learning and the prompting, using prompting and assistance during the therapy process. So maybe you can comment. I just think about the process when I start to learn the Chinese, for example. I definitely will do it with the lower anxious level if you use prompts. So I am successful in this. Maybe you can just give some comments about this for specialists.
Yeah, I 100% agree. And I think that's where the visuals come in too, you know, making sure that you've got those prompts to help that child succeed. Because at the end of the day, what do we all want? Every single one of us, we want to look good and feel good. That's it, right? Everybody wants that. So when a parent says to me, my child is acting up when I ask them to do this, and I'm like, well, they're not getting out of anything out of that activity. They're not feeling good about it. They're not looking good. They don't care. You know, that's for a lot of my typical clients, that's the case. But with a child with autism, you know, you have to figure out what makes them feel good. And if you can't tap into that reinforcement, it's going to be very difficult to get them to engage. And prompting is a way to make sure that you teach your child success, and success is contagious, right? So my son who had struggles, and he's the reason I started a learning lab in London and in Chicago now, and we service kids all around the world, but he hated math, hated it. I mean, he was 8 years old and I would have to peel him off the floor to do anything related to math. But once he went through a program and he learned how to do it, and it's all precision teaching and a lot of errorless teaching, like you were saying, now he tells the doctor, oh, I'm really good at math now. What changed? What changed was the way we taught him. It was not just, here it is, do it. It was errorless teaching and reinforcement. Those are the two things. So if you're a parent with a child with ASD, figure out what their payoff is. What do they like? If they like bacon, I had a client who loved bacon. And I told mom, I said, great, then save it for when you want him to work. You know, and the nice thing about bacon is the smell. It was like, he already knew it was coming. So figure out what they are reinforced by, use that to motivate them. But once you do that, the sheer act of doing something and doing it well will be motivating.
Great, thank you. This is a motivational speech, but this is so important, yes. So let's speak a little bit about assessment process. How do you assess the developmental level of self-care skills? And also maybe you have some tips for parents, how they can assess the self-care skills.
So if we want to pick one skill, so give me one self-care skill that you'd like to.
Let's take dressing.
Dressing, okay. So what I would say in OT, this is what we do, and this is what I do, is I looked at what we called an activity analysis, which I think is also called a task analysis. What are the steps that Johnny needs to put his t-shirt on, right? write out those steps. And there's so many resources on the internet that you can find a visual, pick up your shirt, hold, you know, put it on your head, that sort of thing. But what I like to do is take each one of those and practice each step to fluency. So I'll give you an example. When you're putting a shirt on, right? Forget getting the shirt in the right way. Like let's just, the actual act of putting a shirt on is hold it here and put it on your head. And I forget this is a podcast. So I'm holding my hand up over my head and I'm putting the shirt over my head. So I think in OT, we would go, okay, the first step is put the shirt over your head and then pull, right? Second step. I like to teach my students and my learners to practice that many times, because all the, if you practice those skills to a level where you're fluent at them and it's easy, then the sheer act of putting a whole shirt on is going to be so much easier. The problem I see often is, and I've encountered it when I try to teach a client to do it and do all the steps. So you've got to break it down to really tiny, tiny steps. And I mean tiny. Like, you know, if you're putting the shirt on over your head, practice that 20 times. Okay, do it again. Okay, do it again. Okay, do it again. Make it a game. And that's the other thing. You've got to have fun. If the child is not having fun doing it, you've lost the problem. You know, you've lost him. You're done. So, for example, I'll put a timer on for two minutes, and I'll say, okay, Johnny, let's put our shirt on as many times as we can in two minutes, and we'll just practice that. And sometimes I use a hat because it's very similar motion, right? You just put a hat on. So, and then once we know that he's really good at that skill, then we move on to the next skill, which is got to find that hole for your arm. Mm-hmm. So then he would find the hole for his arm, put his arm through, and then I take it out again and go, okay, let's try it again. Okay, let's try it again. You know, that's the one thing that I've learned over so many years and being a precision teacher and an OT, you've got to build fluency.
Yeah, so how it happens in like everyday activities, for example, we teach him to do one step, and other steps we help him to do physically with our physical assistants, or we continue teaching all the steps during one activity, for example, putting on the short.
I would have him do the first step, practice it a few times. So say 20 times you practice putting it over your head, first step, then help him do mm-hmm. the rest. Then when he can do it by himself, like I would do that for a week at least. And then after a week, you think that he can do it again or do it by himself. He'll do it by himself. Then you do the next step, do it 20 times, help him with the rest. Then it's the other hand. Now do it 20 times, then the rest. So it's sort of a graded assist.
Yeah, I also think about the situation that in this case, we can use this kind of strategy if child cooperates well, but if he's not cooperating well.
Again, you've got to have fun. And if you can't have fun with the child, then you can't teach them because they're not going to be engaged. So you have to make sure the sensory environment is right. So don't use the shirt he doesn't like, the rough shirt. Pick his favorite shirt. That would be a key. Second thing is, that's why I like to use the timer, because kids get excited. And I'll say, okay, if you can do it 20 times in 1 minute, then we get to play your favorite game of tickles or I don't, you know, whatever that reinforcer is, you know, or all we're going to do is do it 10 times and do a countdown. Okay, one, oh, good, two, oh, three. You've got to reinforce with yourself as a parent. Believe me that parents are the most reinforcing for their children. You know, my son, he can get A's, he can get 10 out of 10, but when he brings it to me, that's when he feels reinforced. When I go, that was amazing. So do not forget the power of saying positive remarks while your child is working with you.
Yeah, thank you. So we can have different kinds of examples about different self-care activities. So the first example is parents share that a great difficulty for their children can be to tolerate changes in clothes due to season change. So a child can refuse to take off his winter hat when summer comes, or to put on his coat when winter comes. What is the possible cause of this problem, and what can be possible recommendations to improve the situation?
Well, the possible cause is a just behaviorally change. They don't like change, you know, and most of us don't like change. I mean, reality, we like, and we like things predictable, right? Those are the two things. And when children with sensory issues, they have a system, an internal system that does not adapt well to change. So naturally they don't want change because that's hard for me. So that's the reason. And then there's obviously a lot of behavioral reasons too that, you know, I'm not going to go into, but if they're getting a lot of attention for resisting, they're going to keep resisting. So that's a whole different story. But how you can help with that is, you know, using social stories and calendar. Start reading books about, oh, summer is coming. And in summer, these are the things we do. So, because you want to hit it from so many aspects, you want to do a cognitive aspect. So that's cognitive, right? You're reading social stories, presenting them with the information and why that would be good. The second thing I would recommend is playing dress up with all those items that they're not used to, you know, like, so let's just say it's winter and say, oh, guess what? We're going to pretend we're going to have a picnic. What would you wear if we're having a picnic, and just do it inside? So those are really fun strategies that kids love. The other thing that you can do is, you know, prepare them for the change using siblings or peers, and then a countdown. Like I use this with my kids a lot when they were little is, you know, have you seen those Christmas countdowns? Have you seen those?
Yeah.
Okay. So take that and make it a countdown to summer. So countdown to t-shirt time, so that they have these prompts and visual cues that in 10 days, we're going to be wearing this. So that's going to be one aspect too. Mm-hmm. The last thing I would say is, again, making sure that children are, have those items around. Like, don't put them away, because out of sight is out of mind. You've got to have them around. And, you know, so when you're reading those social stories, hey, Johnny, which t-shirt would you wear in this situation? Or reading any bedtime story, say you're reading about, you know, going to the fair. You don't typically go to the fair in winter, right? What would you wear, Johnny? Show me in your closet what you would wear. So those are just tips and strategies that I would use.
Thank you. So the next example, like a common example, is when a child refuses to get his hair wet or hands wet, and it makes more like showering and bathing struggling for parents. What are the possible causes while child refuses, and what possible strategies to manage it?
So getting their hair wet, there's several reasons. From a sensory perspective, it could be they don't like how water feels, or they don't like the actual feeling of water on their head. They're two different things. So the first thing I would do is make sure you figure out which one it is. If your child doesn't even want to touch water with their hands, then they're not going to put it on their head. So you've got to start there first. But if they can tolerate playing with water, but they don't want their hair wet, that's a different. And then even with hair wet, you have to analyze it and go, okay, do you not like your hair wet because it sticks to your neck? Or is it the feeling, oh, you know, when you have wet head, like it feels cold and it feels like heavier? You have to analyze what aspect of the activity is truly bothering them.
Okay.
And that's what a lot of people fail to do. Because once you figure that out, you can figure out how to help them. So for example, if I know they can tolerate on the head, but they're going, I don't like it on my neck, you know, then I can say, oh, I have a solution for that. You know, then we just cover this part, make sure the wet head doesn't touch it. Or say they don't like the water. My kids, when they were little, didn't like the water in their eyes. So there's a great modification for that. There's like a plastic visor that you can put. It doesn't happen. But if for some reason they don't like the actual feeling on their head of water, that's a little trickier to manage. And that's something that you'd have to really work on desensitizing. So some of the things that I've used is, you know, putting a cold pack on their head, getting them used to feeling that. Because when you come out of the shower, your head is cold, your scalp. So, you know, using that. The second thing I would say is combing or brushing their hair. Are they tolerating that? Because then it's not a tactile issue, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you have to sort of figure out what is the actual very precise thing that's bothering them. And so then you say you figured out, okay, they just don't like the feeling on their head of water. Then it's a matter of, okay, you know what? We're going to have to find something to pair this activity with. Like a YouTube video. And sometimes it's using distraction because it's something you have to do, right? There's nothing, you can't not wash your hair once a week at least. So pairing it with something they like, and then just doing sections, starting with that. Say, you know what, today is left side day. All we're gonna do is wash your hair on the left side. And so you can watch your YouTube video while I just wash your hand left side. So again, you're grading that activity. Okay, today it's middle side. I don't know. I'm just making stuff up. But that's, you know, that's what I would do.
Yeah, great. Again, the great point is about analysis, that we need to think and make analysis. We have no common story about the person with autism, and this is the most important point. Yeah. Okay, now you will need to tolerate my English a little bit more because I will read a long example. So we will discuss examples about toileting problems in children with autism. I think this is a great and difficult topic. So this can be a common occurrence of challenges parents can face trying to teach a child to use a potty or toilet. And it is a possibility for a child to wear a diaper until 6 years old, because every time a parent tries to put a child on a toilet, he refuses to sit down, and the process can end with problem behavior. And we understand that parents may give up, as problem behavior is something they want to avoid in the future. And the question is, what can be the possible problems why a child refuses to sit down on a toilet or on a potty, and also to use, even if he like tolerates sitting, but he refuses to do all the stuff?
Okay. So again, from a sensory standpoint, I can tell you that the sound of the toilet is very scary, you know, for a lot of children, and also the feeling. So I guess I'm trying to, how do I explain this? But like when you have a child, let's just say a typical child, they're wearing diapers and then they get to the stage where they void on the toilet, correct? That change between the feeling of going in your pants and the feeling of going into air, for lack of a better word, that's a different sensory experience. So for us to expect children with sensory issues, like typical children who don't have a lot of sensory issues, have a hard time with that process sometimes, right? So children with ASD who have really difficult time with sensory aspects, that's a big change for them. And to expect them to do that is very difficult. So you have to really ease into it. So the first thing I would say is don't even expect them to take their diaper off. Just have them sit on the potty, even with the diaper on. That's the first thing. They have to learn to tolerate the environment. So, you know, if flushing is an issue, you've got to get them used to the flushing sound before you can have them sit on the toilet. Has to happen. Otherwise, you're not going to have them go. You can have them go in a porta potty or whatever, but they're going to be so afraid of that that it's not going to happen. So those are the first few things. And then, you know, it's going to be, toileting is, it's such a precise format, right, that you have to follow. Like, you have to make sure they're full of liquids if you want them to go, you know. But so that's that behavioral component. You've got to make sure they're full of liquids, and then when they go, they get a huge reinforcement, that sort of thing, right? So that's the behavioral part. But the sensory part is they've got to be able to sit on the potty before the expectation of doing anything in it. That's the first tolerance. Because if they don't have good vestibular system, they don't have a good sensory system, that's going to be hard for them to do. Make sure their feet are flat on the floor. If you need a step stool, then you have to put a step stool. Because sometimes children have sensory issues, they don't have good balance, and you don't want their feet dangling. It's going to not make them feel secure. So that's the second thing. The third thing would be, once they've started sitting on the potty, then it's time to say, okay, can we just, even if they poop, then they're doing it in the bathroom because they're sitting there. They're just not going in the toilet. Does that make sense? So yeah. They still have their diaper on. They're sitting on the potty. They poop and you say, oh, good job pooping. And then you take the diaper and you empty it into the potty. Then slowly you get to the point, and I've done this with a client, but I wasn't able to see her for a long time, so I don't know how it happened. We ended up, so she had the diaper on and sat on the potty for a while, and then we ended up cutting the diaper from the back slowly until it was not there, and she just, then we were able to take it out. So the one thing you have to remember with children with ASD is do everything very slowly and very tiny, tiny steps. And they have to get used to so many things before they're ready for the big step.
Yeah, and I think the more challenging part is teaching a child with autism to poop in the toilet. Mm-hmm. And I also have one example. For example, if a child is at home without trousers and pants, he can go to the toilet, but if he is wearing his pants or trousers, he can poop in that. So how do you think, why can this happen?
I have to think about it. Give me a second. So they're pooping. If they don't have pants on,
he goes to the toilet by himself, but if he has pants on or trousers on, he poops in that.
Yeah, a lot of kids do that. You know, and I can only take a guess in that situation. I don't work on toileting. Mm-hmm. That's not something, that's not my specialty. But, you know, you have to make him going on the toilet a lot more valuable than him pooping in his pants. That's how I would approach it. I would say, and he obviously likes pooping in his pants. I think he likes the feeling. My guess is, because nobody wants to do that. So he's getting something out of it, right? That's what I, whenever I look at a child and I go, what are they getting out of it? Are they getting attention? Is it a sensory need? Or are they avoiding something? Something's happening. So in this case, he is, maybe it's a sensory thing, I don't know. But he's avoiding like playtime, or not playtime, toilet time, because he wants to play, my guess is. So you have to think, I think that's where behavior comes in. You have to look at the ABCs of behavior. What's happening before? What's happening after? So if he poops in, he doesn't have pants on and he poops, are you making him clean up? Because if you're not, to him, he's like, well, I can just, if you are making him clean up, then he's like, I don't want to poop on the floor. So I'm going to go to the potty.
Yeah.
Right? But if he has pants on and he poops, and then you clean him up, you're doing all the work, and then he can go back to playing. So in that situation, I would look at behavior.
Yeah, I think the problem is about teaching a child to poop in the toilet because it doesn't happen so usually as being in the
Oh, that's
toilet.
often.
So it's so hard to plan the process how to teach him in this case.
Yeah, and you know, that's going to take a lot of analysis on the child from a sensory standpoint, but also from the behavioral standpoint. And I think that's why they sort of work together. I will tell you from the sensory standpoint, that's where that interoception comes in. Like a lot of children don't like that feeling of pooping. They will hold it in too. I've seen that a lot. But that isn't easy to manage. That's a tricky one, and it needs, I would say, you have to find a team of therapists to help you navigate that. But generally speaking, I look at behavior in those situations.
Yeah, and you need patience. You need to be
Oh,
ready
what?
that it is not an easy skill to train.
It's very difficult, but I will tell you, if you get them to poop on the toilet, whether it's without trousers or whatever you've decided to do, you've got to make that the best day of their life, like a birthday party. Because, and I did this with my son. My son was not, he was two, and I was like, yeah, I'm done with diapers. I want to, and he was my last, so I was really done. But I remember when he went poop on the potty, I had a big to-do. I had a present, like I had everything ready, and we were calling our relatives and telling them, and he was telling everybody I went poop on the potty and got a lot of attention. So that I can tell you, you really need to make a big, it needs to be bigger than his birthday.
It's
That's how,
party for everybody.
yes.
Yeah, I guess. Yeah. Okay. So let's transition to adulthood and speak a little bit more about self-care skills in the teen years. So, can you share some important self-care skills to address in teens with autism? It's like a common question, but just to mention, what skills are more important self-care skills in teen years?
Well, I mean the basics obviously, but for teenagers, for girls, managing their periods is a huge skill that OTs address. And hygiene in general is a huge issue because I used to work in a school setting, and this boy was there, and nobody wanted to be his friends because his ears were always dirty. And it's such a simple thing. And but nobody talked to the parent to say, need to clean his ears. So as a parent, I think that's the biggest advice, is making sure that your child is hygienic. Like their nose is not always running. They don't have nasty, crusty ears, or because especially when you have a child with special needs, there's so many things that you have to take care of. I absolutely understand why parents are like, yeah, that's the last thing I'm worried about right now. But that is a huge component. And then of course, social skills. We don't typically in OT work a lot on social skills, but knowing and understanding personal space, like we work on that, understanding social rules. Though that's really like, when you cross the street or when to answer the door, those sort of things. And then safety is another one. Home safety is a big skill that I emphasize with kids. You know, knowing when the microwave, the stove is off and on. Those are probably the key areas that I focus on.
Yeah, thank you so much. I think this is another podcast theme.
Yeah.
Like self-care, social participation, etc. in teens. This is really another topic. So just to mention, maybe we can have this topic someday after that. I don't know. So do you have some additional comments to parents who have children with autism?
I think if you have access to therapies, I think it's really important that you use as many resources that you have. But the one caution I would give you is don't get married to one therapy, because not one therapy has all the answers. You know, just because you found a speech therapist you like, don't just say, oh, well, that's all I need. No, you've got, because there's no way for one discipline to know everything. And the best way to maximize progress and, you know, get your child where you need to be, you need a team to work together. So I would definitely constantly look for more. And I know now, I know you said there weren't many OTs or therapists in Baltic Latvia. State, is it?
Mm-hmm. In Latvia.
So telehealth is such a big opportunity. You know, I know I have two clients in Saudi Arabia that I see, and I just consult with them on OT. Mm-hmm. So I think telehealth has really opened the base. So, you know, I would definitely say reach out and find opportunities, even if you're just consulting, because at least they can give you specifics. This episode, it was great information, but again, it's very general, right? Because it's not going to apply to every child. That's probably my advice, is make sure that you have a multidisciplinary approach and you reach out and even get consult, if nothing else.
Yes, I always think how many things parents need to know and how they need to struggle in everyday life really to improve their development and the quality of life of their children. This is such a great and hard job.
And I also think, Olga, that parents are the best way. You know, because as a therapist, I see a kid maybe once a week or twice a week. I can't make the change, but you can even, and I tell parents, if you can even do 15 minutes a day, add that up. Yeah. 15 times 365 days, or even just 300 days a year. That's a profound difference mm-hmm. than what I can do. You know, because I have to build rapport. I mean, there's so much that I have to try to, and you already have that. And moms are the biggest reinforcers. You've got to figure out, you know, if you're the one they're going to do things for. So you just have to figure out a team of people who can guide you. And I know that's hard and it's overwhelming. I'm not going to pretend it's easy. I get it.
Yeah, thank you so much. It was very valuable that you shared your knowledge about different examples and showed this in practical way. So even if this is a small information in 1 hour, I think it gives a lot of answers on different kinds of questions just to understand. If you understand, it's easier to analyze in everyday life still. So this is a great podcast in this case.
Well, thank you so much. And, you know, I'm happy to help. Please feel free to reach out. I do have a lot of resources too. And as I said, I'm doing YouTube videos. I'm doing one actually on family dinners and the importance of family dinners and how to get your kids to sit still, because there's so much research on that. So that kind of goes into self-care. That's my latest episode.
Great. Thank you so much.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.